Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Ind AS series on Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code, Part 4, Analysis of Ordinance 2018, Amending the Code, and What Next. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star followed by zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. Thank you, and welcome to the participants to our series. And this has been, in a way, a very successful series for us because we have been holding this series since the last 2 months, and this has been the fourth part of our series. The first, we did it on April 10th, then on May 2nd, May 24th, and we are on June 14th. And we have been able to, continue this series, which has been very, very fruitful and engaging with the audience. We see a lot of people who have joined in most of this, series on all four occasions, while we also see a lot of new participants on each occasion. So it has been very, very encouraging for us. As we say, there is never a dull moment in India, and I think Insolvency Code is, one of the examples. Maybe that's the reason why we have been able to do four in the last 2 months. So since the Act came into force in December 2016, we have already seen two major activities in terms of amendments, why we have not yet seen the second anniversary of the Code itself. That itself, I think, gives us two signals. One, very positive, that the government is not shying away to amend, modify, or tweak the law to suit the requirements, learn from the practicality. And I think that this is a great move by the government to address the concerns immediately rather than it becoming an issue for even, the basic implementation of the Code. The negative part of that, I feel, is that it is a bit reactionary. Sometimes looking at short-term issues maybe this exercise may have to, keep happening, going forward as the time changes, as the requirements changes, as the objective changes. But I think it's a good thing that we are moving forward as part of this process, because this is something which is really, really important for Indian economy to make sure that the restructuring and insolvency provisions work as well as, any other law in India. With that, straight away to jump into the discussions today. So we will be touching upon some of the important amendments brought in through an ordinance recently to the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code. I have been joined by my colleagues, Simon Brees and Karan Kalra, who are senior members and leads the corporate transaction practices at the firm, and they are heavily involved on advisory on the Insolvency Code, and also by Ashish Kabra, who primarily does a lot of disputes and litigation, and is based out of Delhi, but also focusing on the Insolvency Code. So, the way we want to structure today's discussions is that we want to touch upon four major topics. First, we will deal with the issues related to the guarantee obligations and how does Insolvency Code apply in cases of corporate and personal guarantee. What was the law before and how it changes after the ordinance. Then we will touch one of the most controversial section of the times, which is the 29A, dealing with the eligibility of the bidders as part of the insolvency process. as to who can give a resolution to people. Then there are some matters related to the voting thresholds at the committee of directors as to what they can do and not do based on the percentage of voting. And there has been some clarity which has been put into the ordinance. Fourth, we will also touch upon the advent of the new category of creditors for the first time, which is the home buyers. This was also reactionary in the sense as to there were quite a few instances of real estate borrowers which are going through or may go through this process, and where does the home buyers have a say or where they stand as part of this process. So there are some clarity on that. There are positives and negatives, so we'll touch upon that as well. And then there are small other procedural matters which we will touch upon depending upon the time available to us. We are going to do a 1 hour from now, so we'll spend about 40-45 minutes talking about some of these topics, and then we'll also make sure we have enough time for interaction. So please stay along till the end, and we'll be happy to answer some of the issues, concerns, suggestions, comments of the audience on the phone, because this is not a training or a teaching lesson. This is more of an interactive session where we want to bring in some kind of a change as part of this process. So with that, let me start with Karan Kalra. There has been a lot of jurisprudence which came about in last 2 years related to whether moratorium applies to the guarantors, whether you can sue guarantors straight away under the insolvency code, when is the obligation of guarantors kick in, what is the jurisdiction where you can apply for the purpose of the insolvency code, so on and so forth. So maybe, Karan, if you can have a quick review of where we stand on this issue, and then, of course, if anyone has any issue or a point that she wants to make on this, and then we move on.
Sure, Dr. Thank you. I take you back to probably our first session where we started talking about key issues that we wanted to cover over the span of this series that we were doing. And one of the key ones was how do guarantee proceedings be dealt with. Are they separate proceedings because they belong to a separate entity who's given the guarantee, whether that entity is an individual or, of course, a corporate, or should it be taken jointly and along with the corporate debt or CIRB proceedings of a corporate debtor? We didn't get the opportunity to take it up after that introduction because, frankly, the law never moved. There were recommendations from the Insolvency Law Committee report that we thought we should get plugged in. But it took its while, and now with the ordinance that's finally now the law, this is the second ordinance issue that was released on 6th of this month, it has made its way into the law, and there have been some very positive steps. Of course, the positive steps and some confusions when we talk about it. Where does the law stand today, right? And why is it there? Interestingly, how should proceedings against a corporate guarantor or a personal guarantor be dealt with? It's something that was not provided for and not articulated in the code. The code did have a moratorium provision, which was section 14, which really mentioned and talked about all the proceedings that should have been stayed, and really dealt with proceedings against the corporate debtor itself or the assets of the corporate debtor, and also restricted the corporate debtor from dealing with its own assets. But it was silent when it spoke about the guarantee. Now, guarantee in India, and unlike many other jurisdictions, is probably there in every single large debt. Non-recourse financing is very, very remote in India, and therefore, these were always tied in. Also, when you did credit enhancements, guarantees crept in, and also when some of these loans since their NPA is now arguably restructured, further guarantees, things like personal guarantees also crept in. So the importance to deal with this was high, but we didn't really have a fix. I identified that the problems were really threefold. One, whether parallel proceedings can be made against against the guarantor when the corporate debtor is below a bankruptcy proceeding, or the moratorium should apply. This was really the first issue. The second issue was whether, if parallel proceedings were allowed, should they be clubbed with or moved to the same forum as where proceedings against the corporate debtor were there, or should they be dealt independently? And I think the third issue that was there was, what happens if the corporate debtor goes bankrupt on its own, and then does it have any implication on the, the guarantor goes bankrupt on its own, and does it have an implication on the bankruptcy of the corporate debtor and the proceedings there? The first time we really saw a stir was when early, I think in January this year, the papers said that certain bankers, and specific bankers who had guarantees protecting or rather securing the debt of the SR group, were going to proceed against the guarantors. And also the other issue that came up was, listen, what happens, because these are all consortium loans, what happens to those lenders who didn't have the benefit of the guarantee? There was a lot of noise, and I do believe that some of the lenders did initiate proceedings, but none of them have really concluded till date. Interestingly, different views were being taken by not just different fora, but the same fora as well. In two cases that became fairly popular, one was Alpha and Omega Diagnostics versus Asset Reconstruction Company, and also Swiss Imeda Private Limited versus Phoenix ERC. NCLAT took a view that the moratorium should not apply and that the guarantee proceedings can proceed on their own and could be separate or parallel proceedings. Interestingly, however, the NCLAT itself, in the case of State of India versus V. Ramakrishnan, took the opposite view, and the Allahabad High Court also took the opposite view in the Sanjeev Shriya versus State Bank of India case. It's really undecided law and didn't know where it should really end up. In March, the Insolvency Law Committee report came up and made two viable suggestions. One was, of course, to have a common forum for these proceedings, and the second was that, yes, the moratorium should not indeed apply to guarantee proceedings. Before I go on to what the amendments are really brought in and what, where that leads us, the upper person, Mohan, if you had any thoughts to bring in.
Yeah, I think maybe one thought in terms of the amendments. Now, does it make it clear that in terms of the guarantee proceedings, one, of course, that it will go into a common forum, but this, does this apply only in relation to the proceedings initiated as part of the guarantee obligations? Or will this also apply to any other proceedings against that entity, as long as that entity is a guarantor to any other borrower who is also continuing with an insolvency proceeding? I think there is a little difference to say that in it to be clubbed into one forum so far as it relates to the same debt, and it is different to say that they will be clubbed into one forum for two different debts. So is that clear under the law, or do you think there is some ambiguity there?
Yeah, but really there is an ambiguity. I think the easier one first, where there hasn't really been a situation. As far as saying that the moratorium applies, the amendment is straightforward. The moratorium, Section 1420 says the bankruptcy proceedings against the guarantor of a corporate debtor are outside the ambit of the moratorium, and therefore parallel proceedings can take place. Few definitions and cleanup changes have also been made. But the one that you raised is probably very interesting. This is the amendment to Section 60, which actually talks about which is the appropriate forum to bring about proceedings before the court. And what it says is that proceedings against the guarantor should be brought before or transferred before the same adjudicating authority that is trying proceedings against the corporate debtor. But it doesn't make a distinction as to say what led to these bankruptcy proceedings against the guarantor, which in effect it means that no matter why, if an entity that's given a guarantee is under a bankruptcy proceeding and a corporate debtor for whom is given a bankruptcy a guarantee is under bankruptcy proceeding, unconnected to each other, will still need to necessarily be brought into one forum, which really gives it a very, very wide connotation and interpretation. Because, I mean, think about it, right? Every single operational creditor now of that guarantor every single financial creditor of that character will be brought before a different forum and will have to now restart or at least transfer and reinitiate proceeding steps before that new forum. If you ask us, I think a initial or a major reaction to this is maybe far-reaching and beyond what was really intended. What was intended was to bring those homogeneous proceedings together. The guarantee proceeding or against the guarantor for that particular guarantee, whether the default should have been brought again, you know, alongside the proceeding where the corporate debtor has been tried. And not everything, because, you know, this is, you know, for lack of a better example, is going to be a legal tourism for a lot of lawyers and not really going to help the cause.
Sure. So, I guess on that, we are already expecting one more amendment. I don't know what more is required, but definitely this is a lacuna or ambiguity which I heard requires a clarity through jurisprudence or amendment to the law. So, moving a little more further on the aspects of the ordinance, and I think, again, as part of the experience on the SR insolvency proceedings or the restructuring proceedings and the Bhushan experience, I think a lot was discussed a year back in terms of who can be or who can be the resolution applicant. Can people who are already subjected to or who are responsible for bad loans can be part of it, or there has to be some cleansing process before you enter into a resolution application status. I think 29A was already introduced. But the criticism of 29A was that it is too wide in terms of ambit, covering entities which may or may not be subjected directly in terms of the resolution process, but still, because of those entities, the dealer community was shrinking, which was not a great sign for a process of resolution, because then you don't get competitive rates in the process, and which is the main objective. So, to at one end, to allow anyone and everyone who are tainted, on the other hand, to make this community too small. That you really don't get the value of the assets of the debtor or the borrower under the insolvency. I think it needs to be balanced. And this is what the committee report was trying to address. But what I understand is not everything what committee suggested has been accepted in the ordinance. So, if you want, do you want to give a little flavor to this 29A? And I think my question to you is this enough? Are we done with amendments to 29A, or this is just a starting point?
Yes, Yagur. I think we discussed 29A, I think, in almost all of our webinars, mainly because it has such a wide import. And I think consistently, the criticism of 29A is it really necessary when the entire code is geared up to ensure that maximum value is received for the asset, so that the economic crisis that exists with bad loans is taken care of? But be that as it may, I think let's discuss 29A in terms of what it is supposed to cover and whether the committee report was taken into consideration. And to what extent was it taken into consideration? So, Jacob, you mentioned the fact that 29A was considered to be a wide-reaching restraint on bidders. And the Insolvency Law Committee report of 2018, that came out in March 2018, seconded with that statement. And in fact, it suggested the universe of resolution applicants that should be constrained by this criteria should be limited. The opening statement of 29A has a wide has different levels of or different kinds of individuals or people that are actually caught within this realm. I think step one is the resolution applicant itself. Step person two is any person acting jointly or in concert with the resolution applicant. And limb three is connected person or the resolution applicant or any person acting jointly or in concert with such person. Now, the committee report suggested that these limbs be reduced to just two. One is just the resolution applicant, as well as its connected person. And the committee report said that that universe of bidders should be sufficient to take into effect, you know, what the control the concern that Pinyani was actually trying to address. But this statement or this advice of the signing of the committee report was not taken in its entirety by the ordinance, and therefore the criteria of people that are now subject to this restriction continue to be the resolution applicant, any person acting jointly or in concert with such person, and the connected person of both the resolution applicant and the person acting jointly or in concert with such person. There is no definition of what a person acting jointly or in concert with such person really is. And therefore, perhaps the Sebi Takeover Code might be a legislation that you would have to call to see what this really would mean. Now, what the ordinance does, however, is provide some leeway to two large sets of people. One is with respect to financial entities, and that too, that criteria, there are some limited criteria that financial entities would not be required to comply with. And the second limb, and we can discuss this in more detail, is in the nature of certain criminal constitutions and certain disqualifications that affected related parties of these resolution applicants and connected persons, and this would not taint the resolution applicant. There are two sort of broad subsets which the ordinance gives leeway or, you know, gives you an exception. Everything else continues to be the same. So let's go through, you know, individual criteria that 29A considers to be persons ineligible to be a resolution applicant. As we discussed, this applies to one, the resolution applicant, you know, limb A. Limb B would be persons acting jointly or in concert with the resolution applicant. Limb 3 would be the connected person of limb A and limb B. Now, if any of these is an undischarged insolvent, you are ineligible to be a resolution applicant. Nothing has changed from the way the law existed prior to the ordinance. If any of these three is a willful defaulter in accordance with the guidelines of the Reserve Bank of India, you continue to be ineligible to be a resolution applicant. The ordinance does not change this criteria. Limb 3 is if any of these three has an account or controls a corporate debtor that has an account that has been declared an NPA, and at least 1 year has lapsed from such declaration, then you are ineligible under the previous law. Now, the ordinance provides two sort of exceptions to this, or gives you two limbs to reduce the effect of this restraint. One is the question of at what point in time is the criteria tested. The ordinance now clarifies that the time at which this criteria is tested at is at the time of submission of the resolution plan. So if at the time of submission of the resolution plan, either the resolution applicant or persons acting jointly with the resolution applicant or the connected person of either the resolution applicant or the person acting in jointly with the resolution applicant has an account or controls a corporate entity that has an account that has been declared as an NPA, and 1 year has lapsed from such data classification, you would be ineligible to be a resolution applicant. However, there are, exceptions that existed under the previous law was if you paid the entire amount at the time. So that continues to apply. So if at the time of the resolution plan, you have managed to clear the NPA, then you continue to be eligible. But what the ordinance provides is that if the resolution applicant is a financial entity, and the definition of financial entity has been provided under the ordinance. If the resolution applicant is a financial entity and is not a related party to the corporate debtor, in that circumstance, even if you have an NPA or control a person that has an NPA, you are not disqualified from making this from being a resolution applicant. Kashish, you have
something
to say?
Indeed, Simone. Thank you. And I was noting these interesting points on Section 29A and the ineligibility. Firstly, on the levels which extend to persons acting in concert and their connected persons. And secondly, in context of the timing of submission of the resolution plan. Consideration of the ineligibility. So probably just adding on to what you said on the second point first, it is interesting that probably I'm more giving context in actual scenarios which have taken place, such as the Arcel Mittal case, where the NCLT has specifically ruled that the time at which you consider the ineligibility is on the date of initiation of the insolvency proceedings. Now, that was what caused Arcel Mittal's ineligibility when they had already disposed of the stake of Uttam Galwa. Now, if considering the new position, possibly going forward, it may just be that people who are holding shares in an entity which has an NPA, you could dispose of those shares before applying the bidding and be eligible, as opposed to what was held by the NCLT in those proceedings, which is actual repayment of those NPA dues. So probably this change may have an impact in that sense, where people can start disposing of their assets as opposed to paying off the NPA dues. But we have to see how courts eventually come and look at that aspect. And on the first point that we discussed, which was the extent to which this ineligibility travels, and where the committee was of the view that the way the section is drafted, and with all due deference, there is ambiguity in how the section is drafted. It is extended to persons acting in concert, connected persons of the persons acting in concert. But there's also this other interpretation which has been floating around, which sort of sees that if you focus on what has actually been written or who the connected persons are, then probably one may also say that it does not travel to persons acting in concert or their connected persons. Because the connected persons are any person who is the promoter or in the management or control of the resolution applicant. So it specifically says promoter or management or in control of the resolution applicant. Similarly, in other points, it can also be limited. So there are these two interpretations which are sort of floating around. I'm probably handing back to Simone over here to sort of continue the points on 29A.
Yeah. So I think we'll deal with that a little bit later, Ashish. But just to go back to see, as you rightly said, right, there was the entire issue of at what point in time should this criteria be tested, and I think the law has now provided clarity that this has to be tested in terms of whether or not you are controlling, you are ineligible if you are controlling a corporate entity that has an NPA. So it has to be tested at the time of the submission of the resolution plan, and which is different from what was traditionally held in the Uttam Galwa case, where the NCLT took a view that it had to be at the time of the declaration of the province. So I think it's important to concentrate on this ineligibility, because especially where the exception to the ineligibility gives you the ability if you are a financial entity. Now, it's important to note that this, the way it's drafted today, the exception will only apply if the resolution applicant is a financial entity. And it is unclear that in a situation where a resolution applicant is an individual, for instance, or a corporate entity that is not a financial entity, and that corporate entity has a connected person that is a financial entity, who should have otherwise been exempt from this criteria, it is not clear today under the law whether the exemption would still apply or the individual or the corporate entity that is now the resolution applicant, not being a financial entity, would be constrained by this criteria. Because but for this exemption, you would have been constrained by this criteria, given that you are a corporate entity or you have a connected person that has control over an asset, over a corporate entity that has an NPA. I think there is a probably it's not the intent. This exemption should apply broadly and not only if the resolution applicant is a financial entity, but also if notwithstanding the fact that the resolution applicant is a financial entity, if a connected person is a financial entity as well, this exception to that should apply. I think the next constraint was if you had been convicted for an offence punishable with imprisonment. Now, the committee report had a discussion suggesting that just having a broad statement saying convicted for any offence punishable with imprisonment for 2 years may be a little bit wide-reaching, and therefore discussed or advised the need to include a specific schedule with certain acts that should be considered for this criteria to apply. And the ordinance does take that into effect and has prescribed a specific schedule. So if you are convicted of an offense for 2 years or more are under the act specified under the drug schedule, you would be ineligible to be a resolution applicant. Also, there's another sort of broad and all-encompassing criteria if you have been convicted for an offense punishable with imprisonment for 7 years or more. Now, there are two set exceptions, one of which was borrowed from the committee recommendation. One is that this would not apply if you have been released from prison for after a period of 2 years. This criteria would not apply, so it is a limited constraint and not forever. And second is that it will not apply to a connected person. For instance, if you have a relative that has been convicted of an offense, that change would not be extended to the resolution practice. So these are the two sort of exceptions that have been provided. Similarly, in the disqualification as a director, if you are disqualified as a director under the Companies Act, you are ineligible. There is an exception to carve out this change if it applies to a connected person. So a connected person meaning a relative has been disqualified under the Companies Act, that by itself would not change the resolution. Other criteria like being prohibited from SEBI continue to be the same. The next sort of change is in G, if today you are a promoter or a management of a corporate debtor that has an undervalued transaction, whether the resolution applicant or any person acting jointly or a connected person was in charge of a corporate entity that underwent a perpetual transaction or an undervalued transaction, you would be ineligible to be a resolution applicant. However, what the ordinance does give you is an exception to this, to say that if such a corporate entity has been sort of obtained or has been under your control as a result of a process under this court, you will not be ineligible ineligible in this. I think the next sort of criteria, which has been a subject matter for a lot of debate in the committee report, was if any of these individuals had executed against you. Now, the way the law read previously was that if you had an enforceable guarantee in favor of a creditor and the corporate debtor, and the corporate debtor went for a insolvency process, you would be ineligible to to be a resolution applicant. Then the ordinance changes this to give effect to the recommendations of the committee to say that A, that committee, that guarantee should have been invoked by a creditor and should have been remained and should remain unpaid in full. Only in those circumstances, unpaid in full or part, only in those circumstances will you be ineligible. And not just if you had written a guarantee towards towards such a I think you know the concern of being ineligible should you have a disability under any law continues to be, except that the tense has now changed. It is something that you should be currently under a disability and not what the law used to be, saying that you know even if you had a disability previously, that disability didn't exist at the time of making the resolution a resolution plan. You could still be ineligible. So the law corrects that to say that if you are currently under disability under any international law, you will be only then will you be ineligible to be a resolution applicant. Now I think the important sort of aspect in terms of this entire change in the ordinance is really the concept of introducing what a financial entity really is. Now, a financial entity has been defined quite exhaustively to include persons under the, regulated by the Reserve Bank of India and also foreign banks. So the ARCs, etc. So I think the definition is quite wide. The only sort of other change that needs to be discussed is who a connected person really is. Now, a connected person, as we know, continues to be the same. The only sort of change that the ordinance brings about is that if today you are a financial entity, right, if you are a financial entity, merely by being a financial entity, and if you are not a related party of the corporate debtor, in those circumstances, you would not fall within the ineligibility criteria. You could still be eligible to make to pay the resolution plan.
So long as I think you are a connected person, either one or three, but you are a financial entity, but let's say related to the resolution applicant, then possibly you still get covered. The NMLE still remains this, whether this would be in addition to the exception to point C, then financial entity in itself is made an exception, and whether this would be on top of it. That is to say, okay, you cross the bridge when it comes to clause C, but you get caught if your connected person gets caught as part of H. In terms of the definition of connected person. I think there are still, few situations which are, of course, clear the way the regulations lead, but may not be logical or may not meet the objectives in which, they were, trying to promulgate. But again, we'll see how they are interpreted and, how people use or misuse this provision as we go along. So, moving a little further, and we'll come back to 29A a little while from now, there is also a few changes in relation to the status of home buyers. Now, this is very specific to the real estate corporations. Maybe, Karan, if you can spend a couple of minutes on that, because that is something which was possibly an important change based on the demand.
Sure, Robert. You rightly said demand was a good word. Homeowners community had lobbied for long, saying, look, we need also a status, an ideal status of a financial creditor. And the reason for that was, homeowner felt or the community felt that once they paid in advance for a part payment, but they're not going to get their home, or that company is going to go bankrupt, or it's gone bankrupt. What really happened, and what is their real status? Are they reduced to an operational creditor? In which case, what they would address their liquidation value, or are they a financial creditor? Again, not only have the ability to bring a particular developer before the bankruptcy court, but also form a part of the committee of creditors and have a say, assuming they have the right shareholding percentage there or a membership percentage there to vote. This was recommended by the committee, and luckily this has come through for the community, and now they are regarded as financial creditors. What that does is twofold. A, it gives them a seat in the committee of creditors, and it also gives them, of course, the ability to bring a developer to the bankruptcy or file a bankruptcy proceeding against them. Interestingly, just like in many of the other cases, the NCLAD and the NCLT had taken conflicting views in the past where they should remain, where they should call, and the court really being silent because they really should and what needed to be clubbed. What it does bring with them is also an interesting fact that we were trying to analyze. It'd be very interesting as to how much of a say would these homeowners have, because real estate companies are typically over-levered, and when the leverage is high, will the homeowners, based on how much they've advanced collectively, have enough of a say to have a block or a voting control in the community of creditors or not? If something worth seeing, and there's been some change in the threshold of voting in, you can pick that up briefly after this. But also, it brings in another problem. It says that the committee of creditors will actually now, in the committee of creditors, the homeowners will need to be represented by an authorized representative. Unfortunately, it doesn't talk about yet how do you appoint the authorized representative, how do so many homeowners come together and choose a particular authorized representative, what if I'm a dissenting homeowner who doesn't want to. It's basically saying that the homeowners now de facto, without having homes so far, someone who's just paid advances, need to form a sort of an association or a committee to come up with who this representative would be there to rightly represent their interests. So I think that will also either lead to little more legislation or at least a requirement of this authorized representative being appointed by majority and being consistent by most of the
members. Well, I'm assuming it was to maybe balance the, you know, the number of creditors that would be on the, and similar sort of amendments have been made for bondholders, for instance, where, you know, a trustee is being appointed.
I have a point to one, and this is something that you and I were talking about earlier. The bondholders already have a trustee to represent them.
Correct.
It's a sort of a de facto authorized representation.
I think the only real change, I mean, for the homeowners would be the fact that now, not being an operational creditor, the only value given to them is not limited to the liquidation value. Right? You have, I suppose, the ability to get, have something
back. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think connecting this topic to the issue, because homeowners are included in the COC for the purpose possibly of voting. And what we understand from the law is that voting is based on the percentage value of the credit outstanding. How many percentage is enough, you know, to take decisions and what kind of decisions? In earlier, there was a one-day approach. I guess now there is a three-day approach. Maybe you only want to touch upon it very briefly on that as well.
Yeah. I think the fundamental sort of context of voting is the fact that both secured and unsecured creditors are put on the same platform. Secured and unsecured financial creditors are put on the same platform for the purpose of the voting. Now, like you said, we have a previous case and law contemplated just one voting threshold, which is 25%. If 75% of these creditors voted in favor, you know, you could pass a resolution, pass a plan, and so on and so forth. Therefore, to block a resolution, you needed to have 26% of the financial debt of the company. And therefore, anyone looking strategically to acquire you know, the debt of a company would always look at this 26% threshold. That has now changed, and changed quite substantially. Somewhat based on the recommendations of the committee. There are three sort of bucket lists of voting thresholds. One is a 51% voting threshold, second is a 90% voting threshold, and the third most important one is a 66% voting threshold. The 51% voting threshold you know, is a residual voting category. He says that, you know, unless the law provides for specifically, everything else has to be a 51% voting threshold. So we would assume that matters like, you know, administrative matters for the committee and residual powers would be accomplished through a 51% voting threshold. The 90% threshold is generally used just once, which is to accommodate a withdrawal of insolvency. So anyone, and it is directly places the recommendations or directions of the Supreme Court, which you know, which held that the committee of creditors should be entitled to withdraw insolvency petition, and it shouldn't really go through the residual powers of the Act led to the Constitution of India. It should be granted as a matter of right under the Insolvency Court, which is what has actually happened. 90% of the financial creditors approve the insolvency petition can be withdrawn. And I think the third most important is the 66% voting threshold, which has been reduced from 75%, which applies for decisions like extending the CRP, approving the resolution plan, you know, all the transfer provisions like raising interim finance, all the important criteria, and removal and approving the resolution, the resolution proportional as well. So I think the important resolutions have been moved to a 66% threshold as opposed to the earlier 55. What this will mean now is that even if you have a 26% or a 30 or 40% odd percentage share of the financial debt of the company, let's put this differently. If you are a secure creditor holding 40% of the financial debt of the company, that is not sufficient today to block a resolution plan.
Or maybe 34%.
34.1 will become the
magic number. Yeah, so I think this possibly has been brought in to bring in some little flexibility in terms of how the COC can make decisions so that, you know, they don't have to always wait for everyone to agree to everything. Otherwise, it always becomes difficult considering the kind of strict timelines that we have. Again, I think we have a few minutes left on this before we open up. But I think the last and most important questions. In India, everything is litigated. And I'm sure it will be litigated as to what this ordinance applies. I think there is some clarity on 29A, which says that 29A provisions will apply to the plans which are not yet submitted. So there is a controversy around that as well. Can you resubmit a plan? But I think if you can give a sense as to whether this ordinance applies to everything pending or how it will be interpreted, and then maybe we can have a last word from Ashish if he has any further comments on 29A. And then open the floor.
You're right, Zapak. I think this has been sort of a bone of contention as to how, when the ordinance should apply and when, you know, what will apply when, because there are ongoing plans, and the question is there has to be some sort of certainty for the committee to go ahead. The ordinance does suggest that the committee of creditors will not approve the plan. This is before the commencement of this the audience, where the resolution applicant is ineligible under Section 29A, and they require the resolution plan to invite a special to have a fresh resolution plan where no other plan is available to it. So I think the ordinance does. I mean, this was actually under the previous ordinance, you know, in terms of how this will apply for. For resolution, there was a concern on the previous sort of ordinance as well, how this would apply. This ordinance does make it clear that where the resolution applicant is ineligible under Section 29A, the committee of creditors could require the resolution professional invite a special resolution plan where no other plan is actually available to it.
Okay, so I think possibly the consensus is that so far as most of the provisions concern, I think we should apply it to existing and of course the future proceedings. But as far as the eligibility availability of bidders are concerned, or the resolution applicant is concerned, I think it is very clear that it won't apply to the pending plans. But whether they can reapply and get out of the eligibility is something which we'll see. Maybe Ashish, if you have a maybe 1 or 2 minute.
So, just a few points and which came across notice in different areas. First, now you would have seen that under the code post the amendment, there is a whole provision which deals with how authorized representatives of a large group of financial creditors would act on the committee of creditors. Interestingly, in most debenture issuances, there's a debenture trustee agreement which is entered whereby debenture trustees are appointed, who are usually required to act as per the majority vote of the debenture holders in terms of broad decision making. However, now under the amendment which is now provided, such representative may have to cast his vote on the committee of creditors in accordance with his instructions received from each debenture holder. So whether and how this sort of deviance or let's say conflict between a normal standard debenture trustee agreement and how the Act provides that the representative will act is also something that we need to see and how it plays out. Second, on the withdrawal of the ability now given to withdraw the application post admission with approval of 90% of the 90% of the committee of creditors. Now, interestingly, the committee of creditors is formed by or constituted by consists of financial creditors. Now, an application for insolvency may also be filed by an operational creditor. In such case, somebody may have filed an application, but without his say, the application is withdrawn because the set of financial creditors who constitute the committee of creditors on 90% basis approve such withdrawal. So that is also something which one may have to see how it plays out. So broadly, these were the 2 points. There were others on 29A as well, but probably given the time constraints, we can hold off on those and probably continue discussion further.
Yeah, thanks, Ashish. And maybe now we can open the floor for questions.
Sure.
The audience who are there on the
panel. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, press star and one on the touchtone phone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. The first question is from the line of Nitish Jain from Bristol Elite Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Nitish Jain. My question is more on a macro level. So we have been seeing quite a lot of progressive changes in IBC these days. Also, we are seeing quite a lot of global distress asset investors looking at Indian market. So my question is, there are a lot of new global distress asset investors. So how these changes have been looked upon by them? Are they feeling these progressive changes for them, or they still want to test the market before entering into the Indian market again? So what has been your experience on this side? Thank you.
Yeah. So I think maybe Karan deals with quite a bit on, advising the, distressed funds globally looking at India, particularly some of the important 12 or 15 cases which are going on. But I guess the whole idea of giving some leeway to the category of financial entity and bringing in the provisions where they are regulated by the financial regulator. I think that is something, addressing the concerns of that community and which will bring in a lot of confidence to them that, look, we don't have to worry about our several other portfolios so long as we have a good direction to, look at some of the assets which are now available because of this. But the current,
I think, yeah, but you have the thing on the head, that is the most relevant part, that this is obviously opening up more opportunities and it's in the right direction. This was the only time that we've actually seen the foreign investor community making a lot of changes, rather than the way we obviously foreign investors prefer a level playing field, not too many changes, and transparency and stability in the law. But here, since it's improving, the sentiments are high, which we think would be back and more people interested in more assets. So, positive outlook.
So I think you're right, man. The fact that the bankruptcy code is in place and they are getting also pushing these assets from a commercial perspective is a great idea. But I think the 29A disqualification has dipped the investment a little bit, especially since a lot of them actually would have, you know, have the financial wherewithal to apply these assets, which would perhaps need motives to assist them one way or the other. Therefore, the entire context of ineligibility criteria under 29A has kind of missed the investment community a little bit, as things progress, maybe these criteria might be sort of watered down the lack exactly, and that may help.
What we expect that as we move along and the market becomes a little mature and the regulators and the government has some more confidence that not every NPA is a bad loan or I would say a fraudulent bankruptcy, I think we'll see more mature provisions related to this, where even the existing management and promoters will have some say or some role to play as part of restructuring. And that is where I think we'll see even more participation from the financial sector as well.
Okay. Thank you for your answer.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Supur Nadir from GMR. Please go ahead.
Hi, I had two questions. The first one is regarding the homeowners now being a part of the committee of creditors. So I'm not sure whether they are secured creditors or unsecured creditors, and you know where they would fall in the waterfall of payments if liquidation is happening. I mean, where, how high or low are the homeowners?
I think we put quick answer there. In the interest of time, don't think they can be secured creditors till they've got actually allotment of the land, 30 to 40 technical law under Transfer of Property Act, or of course the undivided share of the land in the Sita property. And then they're likely to be unsecured creditors. The fact that they have a seat on the COC and hopefully can vote, you know, the COC has a reasonable amount of flexibility to decide how much goes in, as long as liquidation values left over for operational creditors. If they're in the first bucket, and within the first bucket will be
I agree for a simple reason that the provisions which are getting changed are not part of the liquidation process under the IBC. The order of preference, once the company is put into liquidation, is a standalone or rather separate provisions than the restructuring. And I don't think there would be any overlap with this. So that position doesn't change when it comes to preferential allotment as part of the liquidation.
Okay, great. And one question on guarantee. So we were discussing how a corporate debtor and guarantor can, you know, there can be parallel proceeding against those. So in a situation where a guarantor is under insolvency, but the company itself is not under insolvency for whom the guarantee was given. Suppose the only the guarantor goes under insolvency, so does that give the holder of the guarantee any rights against the guarantor, or since the guarantee is not invoked, nothing happens?
No, so actually it will not give the person a right, because at the end of the day, you can now in your situation treat this guarantor as a corporate debtor itself. And when the corporate debtor can't dispose of any of its assets and only make payments towards buying essential goods or subscribing to essential services, there is no window for the guarantor to pay. So subsequently, if the underlying debt default, which your guarantor was already under bankruptcy, you're going to be in a situation where you're not getting your guarantee payment coming out of that.
So
only where that guarantee gets invoked at a later date when there is some default in the underlying debt, at that point we can join the committee of creditors?
No, I think if we are overlapping two issues, this will be the committee of creditors for each corporate entity is separate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at a later date, when your underlying loan defaults, and this, you know, your underlying loan and your borrower has become a corporate debtor, and bankruptcy proceedings are already pending against the guarantor in the separate forum, as per the new amendment, they both come before one forum, but the proceedings don't become one. It's not that you now have a common committee of creditors. There's still two separate bankruptcies being done. But for efficiency, it goes before the same forum, so to the extent you need to, you know, have synergies of effort goes to be put in.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Deepak Jain from Raheja Universal. Please go ahead.
Yeah, the question is if the... Hello.
Yeah, Deepak, go ahead.
Yeah, Deepak, this is Om Prakash Rupa.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Om Prakash.
Yeah, if the financial creditor, the banker, while filing the application on the IBC, has made a wrong representation that it has charged on certain assets which the bank has already released long back, and created, the company has created rights in favor of a third party like developer, the land is still shown by the banker as if it is the asset of the company. Where does the developer approach to correct it formally?
I think while all legal recourses, you know, it says there's a bar on other proceedings, I think two things. One, before the NCLT itself, you need to put in your case or facts as to why the charge is being lifted. That would be your first forum.
Okay.
Your ability to file a writ petition is not taken away by the stay on proceedings, and if you think that it needs, is valid, the writ can also be preferred as you've seen in some of the other methods.
So we can intervene before the NCLT itself.
Absolutely. It's a forum, right? It's a tribunal at the end of the day which has to look at each case on merit. And it is the job of the RC and the NCLT to make sure that the claims submitted before them are valid and substantiated claims and not vicious claims.
Okay, because we have directly not got any notice of the IBC application being filed.
Understood. Maybe with a specific query, Mr. Prakash, we can talk about it offline as well. I guess you and Gaffer know each other. We'll reach out to you.
All right. Thank you so much, Gaffer. Thank you. Ashish, I think. Thank you, Ashish.
Thank you.
Reminder to participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question may please press star and one at this time. Participants, to ask a question, you may press star and one.
Maybe I have a question as well. I think with respect to the guarantor, I think it's important now to sign the claim, Assuming you have a claim against the guarantor, you execute proceedings against the guarantor, right? And the corporate debtor is under bankruptcy, and the time for claim has been shut, right? I mean, the window for making claims has been shut. Now the guarantor technically steps into the shoes of the lender. So, you know, in that sense, I mean, is the guarantor then out of the race or has the right to claim?
No, so I think that's an interesting one. Like you rightly said, signing your claim and making it earlier will be important. But also what's important is that the guarantor steps into the shoes of the lender only when it has actually made those guarantee payments.
Exactly.
So if that payment has not been made, which is probably likely, then nothing changes. He will step into the shoes of the lender under a classic contract or guarantee as the law looks at it, which are surety contracts. But if it's also a guarantee that's given on the purposes of a fee, and then you've already waived your right to step in, which is common clauses in most lender contracts, then in that case also you wouldn't step in. So very fact specific. The timing of your claim, who you're proceeding against, when, I think becomes
what is the recourse of the guarantor, I think really becomes
right. So guarantee institutions or third parties giving guarantees, not part of the same group, not the promoter group, probably you have to look at the same more carefully, especially in credit hands today.
Sure. Any other questions?
Yes, sir. We have a question in here from Ashish Shah from Transcontinental Capital. Please go ahead.
I had a very simple question. So once an RP is appointed, the board is suspended and the RP has all the board powers. In a situation where the capital structure has convertible securities, let's say convertible preference shares, and if the plan of resolution requires capital reduction whereby the preference has to be converted to ordinary first and then a reduction in capital, does the RP have the powers to force the conversion of the preference shares?
The answer is yes. So long as it's an approved plan, because this is all part of the restructuring process. We have seen one or two instances in the past as well, practically, where similar situations have occurred.
And I should just, a couple of the amendments that came up with this ordinance actually has this explanation.
So the approval, approval is, whose approval are we talking about?
COC.
As long as approved by COC, not the security holders.
That's
so
right.
It could be crammed down. It could be a part of an approved resolution plan. It doesn't need approval of the security holders.
Correct. That's correct.
In fact, that's what got clarified this time, Ashish, in the ordinance. That if a committee of creditors has approved a plan, the approval of the shareholders is actually deemed obtained. So that actually helps with understanding and getting to this conclusion.
But in that, is there a litigation risk? Because once the NCLT approves a plan, then the RP goes away, and post that, you have a year to enforce the plan. And that, can the securities holders mount a legal challenge?
Our view is that once it is approved by the NCLT, most of these legal challenges would not be very, forceful, unless you show some kind of a real fraud or something which is, completely beyond understanding. It is not a properly, planned, present, and approved, assumed in terms of what is happening. Which does not affect any other, direct violations or something. We really don't see that those litigations will survive once the NCLT is approved.
So I think that there's two things, right? One is that you have 1 year to seek other approvals. So there's a specific deeming provision that says that to the extent you require any approvals under the Companies Act, those approvals would have been deemed given if the resolution plan is improved. So I think that specific sort of deemed position is included by the ordinance. The second bit is that, yes, the ordinance does provide a one-year period in which you need to get other approvals, but it can't take away from the company that approval, which is deemed to be a skip and a resolution.
Just allow, just humor me for a moment. So I'm going to go a little slow through this. So during the pendency of the IBC, the RP has the board powers, and let's say that the resolution plan got approved by the NCLT. Now you're in the post-approval regime. At that point in time, there is no RP, there is a new board. And let's say that you had converted convertible securities and then capital reduction. Now you have minority shareholders, and you have to execute the approved resolution plan. And at that point in time, can the minority shareholders suggest that the conversion was a forced conversion and not really acceptable to them?
No, they don't have a say to say no.
Thank you. Thank you. Reminder to the participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question, may press star and one at this time. Participants, to ask a question, you may press star and one. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, may press star and one.
further questions, we'll announce at the end of the session here. Thanks a lot again for such a lively participation, and we promise we'll come back in the next 2 to 3 weeks. I'm sure there will be something very interesting which will come up by then. Otherwise, we intend to hold a session on a comparative law, particularly from a corporate transaction perspective, as to how the bankruptcy and restructuring law across the globe applies differently compared to India. And we may come up with one or two examples or the models which are very famous or I would say very successful, which may or may not apply in this case, and what kind of provisions need to come in as part of that. So we look forward to discussions of this law translates into more fruitful restructuring and a robust economy going forward. We'll also talk about some of the structuring issues as to how the bidders or the resolution applicants can look at different models of structuring some of these deals as part of insolvency. So we'll circulate some material on this, and then we should come back to this audience again for such participation and interaction. Thanks a lot. And see you again.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference call for today. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.